BFBS Original Music Specials. This is the Forces Station.
This is BFBS.
BFBS Original Music Specials. Touring Breaks in Session.
20 years of touring. Over a million records sold worldwide and one of the undisputed champions of independent British music. This is the story of Touring Breaks.
Tired eyes, maybe you've seen too much. Tired heart, every end has a start. If you find yourself in trouble, falling off the track, would you come back? Would you come back? Would you come back?
In Session.
BFBS.
What happened? I moved school and I went to Gale School, and so I was like the new kid, and Gale had been there a little bit longer than me, but he was quite new as well. So we started hanging out together, and this was like 1985, something like that.
Okay. So how old were we roughly?
Probably about eight.
Yeah.
We became firm friends, and then we got really into Chuck Berry. And funny enough, Little Richard as well. I remember my dad had a Little Richard live cassette, you know, hanging around the car, the Fiat Panda. But but we also had this Chuck Berry tape that my dad managed to convince me and Gail, because he used to give us lifts to school and stuff. This was where it was really at. And we were like so up for it. It was brilliant because no one else in the school had a clue who the hell Chuck Berry was, you know. And then about a year after this, Back to the Future came out.
Big Chuck Berry reference.
Amazing, yeah.
So we'd nailed it. I don't think we've ever been as cool as we were at that moment.
Yeah. Trying to get back to there, yeah. And then we kind of had guitars, and like our parents were friends. We kind of lived close. We were always kind of hanging around and, you know, kicking about, playing guitar lessons together and stuff.
From that sort of starting point, you basically learnt your instruments together, you started to learn about songwriting together, constructing music, and that all sort of happened quite organically just at that kind of very early age.
Yeah, I guess
kind
it did.
We definitely would record stuff and kind of muck around with music, really.
We started recording ourselves as pretty quickly, didn't we? Like, as soon as we could.
Yeah, really. we could get two tracks on the recorder at home. And I remember we'd kind of do, like, covers and stuff for stuff like that. The covers of stuff.
Yeah, I remember you drawing
cassette covers. It was very different, the music then. It really took Ollie going to film school, and that kind of brought another change about, which kind of made it into Turin Break.
We took it a bit more seriously, didn't we, at that point? Yeah, yeah.
Take me all the way back there, the first time you were actually aware of what you thought was cool.
Oh, wow, that's huge, isn't it? But I guess my big, massive influence on me was my sister, my older sister. She got really obsessed. She sort of found my parents' record collection, and she got really into it for a few years. And at first, I thought, what the hell's this, you know? And then after a while, it just kind of, it got into my soul, and I started listening to it all as well. It was all the sort of kind of mid to late 70s American singer-songwriters and things like that. And I really loved it, and it's been my soundtrack ever since. Joni Mitchell's been my sort of favourite thing musically, sort of consistently, since I was about 15. But it's kind of more than that now. It's sort of become a real... I don't know, it's like if I want to feel at home, there's a particular record of hers that I listen to, and it doesn't matter where I am, you know.
And which record is that?
An album called Hejira.
Oh, okay,
which is like when she started to go a little bit more, it's when most people stopped liking her, you know, to be honest. It started to cross into a bit of more of an experimental world, but I totally get that record, and it's just incredible. So I still love it, yeah.
That's nice, I like that. And for you guys?
I remember the first tape that I bought that I thought was cool was Chaz and Dave's Greatest Hits.
They're underrated.
They're underrated,
underrated, yeah. Band.
If they ever make a comeback, I'll claim that it was...
Well, they're actually, I interviewed Chaz and Dave a couple of weeks ago. They're doing all right. They're still touring, and they've got their little allotment. It's where they go and do most of their writing now. Okay. So, yeah, they're good guys.
You know that big Eminem song, Slim Shady? Yeah. My name is Apparently that's them playing that.
It is. It is a true story. Yeah. My name is what? My name is Slim Shady. My name is what? Excuse me. My name is Slim Shady. Can I have the attention of the class for 1 second? My name is Slim Shady. Hi kids, do you like Primus? Yeah, wanna see me stick 9-inch nails to each one of my eyelids? Wanna copy me and do exactly like I did? Try sit and get messed up worse than my life is? My brain's dead weight. I'm trying to get my head straight, but I can't figure out which Spice Girl I want to impregnate. And Dr. Dre said,
Slim Shady, you a basic. Why's your face red, man? You wasted.
Well, since age 12, I felt like a caged elf who shaded himself in one's face, chasing his tail. Got ticked off and ripped Pamela Lee's lips off. Kissed him and said, I ain't no silicone, was supposed to be this soft. I'm about to pass out and crash and fall in the grass faster than a fat man who sat down too fast. Come here, lady.
Shady, wait a minute. That's my girl, dawg.
I don't give a damn. Dre sent me to take the world off.
Hi. My name is what? My name is what? My name is Slim Shady. Hi. My name is what? My name is what? My name is Slim Shady. Hi. My name is what? My name is what? My name is Slim Shady. Hi. My name is what? My name is what? My name is Slim Shady.
My English teacher wanted to flunk me in junior high.
Damn.
Thanks a lot. Next semester, I'll be 30.
BFBS. Turin Breaks. In session.
And you, Eddie, first live gig.
I had a record of the military band of the Coldstream Guards doing the Thunderbird soundtrack. So there you go. That's kind of appropriate for where we are today.
Is that still playing around your head?
It still is, like, yeah, absolutely. It's always there.
You know, on so many levels.
Whenever I it seems like I'm listening to you. Actually, that's what's going
five bombs. Yeah. Four.
So have you seen the new Thunderbirds then?
Yeah. The Thoughts? CGI one. Well, it's not puppetry, I'll say that. Let's leave it there.
no strings attached. I was into, I don't know, when I was a kid, it was just sort of anything. I mean, I just used to listen to the radio all the time, so my taste is kind of all over the shop. But one of the things that got me going was Elvis and rock and roll and Little Richard. And it was actually probably Little Richard, because I said to my mum once, I was trying to catch her, you know, I said, like, Mum, who's the king of rock and roll? Because I thought I'd learnt something that she wouldn't know. And she said, Little Richard. I went, what? No, it's Elvis. She went, no, it's Little Richard as far as I'm concerned. So when I was a kid, I think my grandma must have given me the money or something, but I bought this Little Richard live LP, and it's insane. You know, he is mad.
I had one of them as well.
It's one of the best records I've ever heard, and it's still got so much energy, and it's just, it's what made me get, I got excited, and all of a sudden my adrenaline was bashing out of my whole system, and ever since then I think that's it. It's been, that's, I've just wanted to do music, and it's, so I guess it was Little Richard really. That live album just made me go crazy, and it's rewired my brain in some way.
You're still crazy now.
I'm still crazy after all these years.
Your first live music experience that really touches you, the first time you go to a gig and you see a band play, and even if they're a bit rubbish, there's still something there that you kind of go, wow.
Remember mine. It's a bit weird. I was in Sardinia on a family holiday with my grandparents and my mum and dad and sister and brother, and it was all quite exciting, you know, because we were on this nice, what we thought was a nice holiday. Yeah, it was a nice holiday. Anyway, we were in this Forte village. There was like this holiday village, kind of like you get like the kind of complex, and they had a band playing in the piazza on the Saturday night, and I was left there with a packet of crisps and a Coke to watch this band.
So
and,
70s.
They were called the Spirituals, and I thought they were just like the Beatles or something. they were just a cover band, but it was like seeing the Beatles again. All of a sudden, my adrenaline just went ping, and I was just like, oh my God, this is the best thing ever, you know.
That'll be the Coke.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was running around afterwards. Oh, I saw this band, it was amazing. They're called the Spiritual, you know, and I was just going bonkers. And so I can still totally remember that feeling. And I just now, when I go to a gig, I hate missing the beginning, because it's that first bit when they come on and they first open up, the first song, the first thing they do is so important to me. It just, because it just reminds me of that moment where I kind of just sort of, again, my brain was rewired, and it was just, I mean, who were they? I've never even looked them up. I mean, there were nobodies. I mean, probably half of them are dead, I imagine. But,
Rob, you haven't got a Spirituals t-shirt? Come on, man.
I'm going to make one.
We apologise to any surviving members of the
If you're there, get in touch. We want to support you.
And for you guys?
Well, we probably went to, what was it?
We went to Chuck Berry.
Chuck Berry and Wendy James. And
yeah, so Chuck Berry was with our dads about eight again, and then I think we went to see Transvision Vamp.
Oh, wow.
I don't know how old we were.
We were too young to see Transvision Vamp.
The bouncers saw us and said, you guys are right, do you want to come upstairs? And they gave us a free poster, and they put us on the balcony so we weren't hanging around with all the big people standing around downstairs. Yeah,
all the big boys, cool. I can imagine.
So I mean, we really were like 11 years old. Or
did
something.
You fancy Wendy?
Of course. Everybody fancied Wendy.
I mean, I love to meet her one day.
Okay, so what we'll do, if it's okay with you guys, if we go into Mind Over Money from the Optimus LP, take us back to 2001.
The demo for this song we recorded in Gail's parents' front room. And when Gail plays the acoustic guitar, I am immediately back in that situation. It's one of those real sonic photograph moments for me. But we kept the recording of the piano and the kind of aeroplane and the front door being shut from that demo recording. So even on the Optimist LP, that's Gail walking around with a very long microphone cable around his house and just kind of doing this kind of sonic walk through his house until he just happened to open the front door, and there's this plane and this car that come past, and it's all beautifully orchestrated. It's as if it was scripted, but it wasn't at all. It was just random, and that's still there forever. And I love the fact that, you know, about 500,000 people have bought and listened to that aeroplane flying over a house in Clapham.
It's actually a toilet refilling as well.
I didn't want to say that, because, you know, it's not as glamorous as the aeroplane. That's just one of those funny little facts about that song. Comes right at the end.
We're not going to be able to recapture that cistern in this particular recording, but let's have it anyway.
Backwards, light up my life like a very lost cigarette. Time after time, dear,
still sinking, staring at the ceilings. Does it really matter?
BS Turin Breaks in Session.
So we've just moved the microphone slightly closer to Eddie away from Gail, which has just about caused a riot. So when Door came out, and there was at this very early stage for you guys, that was the time that after sort of NME grabbed hold of it and you got quite a good push from NME to start with, it really made the majors sit up and take notice. Was there a pivotal moment, like a showcase gig, a performance, a meeting in those very early days that was a game changer?
The most exciting moment for me was we'd just done a gig at like the Brighton Crawl Festival or something like that. It was, you know, very, very early days. And our then manager came up and said to me, "You've just been offered your first record deal from Domino Records."
Wow.
And Domino were like the coolest label in the world. But this was before the Arctic Monkeys, you know, this is, yeah, and they had, you know, Elliot Smith and all this stuff that I just adored. And I just couldn't believe it. And I wanted to sign there and there. I was almost like, when do we sign? How do we sign the deal? You know, and he was like, no, you know, chill out. There's going to be about 10 more of these, you know. And he was right. I didn't believe him, but he was right. We ended up literally, I think at one point we had 12 deals being offered to us, which was nuts, you know. But we were really lucky. I mean, the timing was amazing, and it was in it during this time where people that had been putting out dance music and electronic music at the time were getting into the idea of classic songwriting.
Right.
There was this big shift of interest from that particular group of people, like James Lavelle, and suddenly were trying to sign people that he considered or they considered classic songwriters. And me and Gail just happened to turn up at that moment with two acoustic guitars, you know. So it was, we really, really had an amazing couple of years, you know, at that point.
And what about for you, Gail? Memories from that particular time?
There was one gig at the Social that
was this is a club in London. It's kind of a concrete, not
the Heavenly Social. Yeah,
yeah. They put us on. They were looking at signing us, but I kind of realised that most people we didn't know them personally. There was like a handful of our friends, like five or six people, but everyone else was kind of involved with some sort of label. And if you went to the toilet, they were going, "Oh, that would sound great with strings," and you know they were all kind of getting excited.
They're all on drugs. And it was,
yeah, all on drugs. Yeah, and you know that was kind of it's like, okay, right, these. They're all looking at this now.
Those days when you were very, very fresh-faced coming into the industry, were there a lot of people giving you direction, asking you to move into a certain area with your music?
No, we had a really good manager at the time who was, who was very good at... he had a lot of integrity, and when he said something was cool, a lot of people listened to him.
Right.
So he kind of knew how to make us look a lot cooler than we were, which was kind of useful. But so everyone just said do what you're doing. And we were really lucky that way. Like even when they handed us a massive check at what ended up being a big label, they were saying we'll put out the demos you've already done at home if you really want us to. You know, we kind of believe in it that much. So
wow.
We were pretty lucky in that way.
Yeah.
And with our manager sort of pushing through in front, saying the band not going to do this, the band not going to do that, and I want some tea and I want unwaxed lemons and all this kind of stuff. Just made it quite a breeze for us artistically, you know.
Mm. It doesn't seem like many people get that kind of treatment now.
No, this is pre.
Even then, it was kind of unusual.
Yeah, sure.
It's okay now if you're on a tiny, like on really small labels. If you're anywhere near a big label, it's just it's never going
to
happen.
Shoving you from pillar to post, trying to get you to do this and
there's
that.
There's so little risk.
That was what
being taken now.
The original manager Phil did, which was so good. Which was that's what he's great at is sort of seeing something and kind of pushing that idea and not letting it go. He's very tenacious, you know, when he's got something going. He was brilliant at that.
Yeah.
Do you think that having that kind of influence, that person that was a decision maker sort of on your behalf that early on in your career, that helped you stay really pure?
It was hugely important. Like we wouldn't be talking to you right now if that hadn't happened, because we weren't savvy at all. We were just we just liked making music. We didn't, you know, we hadn't even considered the idea of doing it as a sort of serious thing until Phil turned up and kind of convinced us that it was worth it and it was a real thing, you know. And we were like, okay. So yeah, he was a massive influence. After that, I mean, things changed. But once we'd put out the first record and things kicked off to a much larger scale, and luckily for us, lots of people bought the record. That was hugely different after that. That was a whole different kind of pressure, because suddenly there was this kind of weird commercial pressure to repeat.
Yes.
It's like, oh, you've done this once, you've got to now do it twice as big. And that on every album for a couple of albums, that's what happened, you know.
Yes.
And that was really strange.
Yeah.
That was very different.
When The Optimist was released, you received a nomination for a Mercury Music Prize off of your debut album. That must have been absolutely crazy, being put into categories with Elbow and Radiohead and PJ Harvey with your first representation of your body of work.
Yeah.
So tell me about that. I can't even imagine what that would have been like.
We just assumed that was just all normal.
I was going to say that. I can remember that these two guys.
Because Rob had been in the business of, you know, professional musician for like at least 10 years.
10 years.
Right. So he could see it
so
all
I'm
happening.
So I'm saying to them, guys, this is amazing. You've got to enjoy this. This is incredible, blah, blah, blah. And they'd just be like, it's really weird. They just didn't get it. And I was like, guys, this is it.
But we just put the album out and then all
so
these things
just,
happen.
Oh, well,
it's
just normal. That's
part
what
of
happens.
How it works. You know, the label sort all these things out. That's kind of what they do. And we just turn up when they ask
and
us.
And I was
to,
like,
you know.
It's not normal. It's not normal.
We got nominated for a Q Award as well. Like there was a few awards, you know, it did
and
kind of start to
and
feel
the Brits.
And
yeah, yeah.
Started to feel a bit like, of course, this is what you do when you've got a big label behind you. They're all going to give you an award.
That was a very weird night, though, wasn't it?
The Mercury. The timing was unfortunate.
Terrible. September the 11th.
Yeah, I wanted to touch on that because you had a huge stateside tour with Stereophonics, and they all got cancelled. Do you think that in any way hindered your sort of break in to the States?
Don't get these guys
definitely
started.
Uh-oh. Hang on a minute, hang on.
Here we go.
Where's my bleep button?
I would say it totally did.
If you were kind of running a band and you managed to get them doing really well in England, like get The Enemy on your side, get some award nominations, the next thing to do is to take those nominations and that viewpoint and show it to America, because a lot of people in America listen to what's happening in England. It's a taste-making kind of place.
Sure.
But so you need to, if you're going to go to America, you need to have that with you so that people start opening doors and seeing it as something that's very relevant and current. Mm-hmm. Without that, you're just another band trawling around the States trying to convince someone to come to a gig, which is kind of impossible. So that was our moment to do it, and that's what that Stereophonics tour was going to do. Unfortunately, everything else kind of kicked off, but and then that kind of led to a few years of us being behind, and by the time we finally got to America properly,
the heat was gone.
We were kind of yesterday's news. It had all moved on to the new sound from someone else.
It just felt like you're behind the eight ball, didn't it, all the time.
Scuppered by terrorists yet again.
You know. It was.
No, we're working on that. We're working on that for you. Don't worry.
Keep going.
It was. We're not bitter about it necessarily, but it's like in retrospect, we've kind of worked out that's what you would do if you were running the business of running a band. That's kind of your method, you know.
Sure. I mean, it was still very successful. You still went and toured. You did 80 dates, and they were very well received. You had really positive reviews at that time. But obviously, with the clout of someone like Stereophonics, who were just absolutely huge at that time,
we probably would have tapped into a ready-made thing.
And we'd already we'd toured with Travis and the Phonics in all over Europe before that, and it had been a massive part of the growth of Touring Breaks was we winning over their fans all over the place.
Sure.
It was massive. So that's what the idea was, to repeat that in the States. So it was looking pretty good.
We did go on tour there, but the thing is, it's easy to do that when you've got a label that's spending money on you doing that. It was a big blow to us, that. And one of the most dramatic things was we were rehearsing for the ceremony we were playing at the Mercury's that day, and the cameraman's just gone ashen in front of us, and he's looking at something down his viewfinder. He said, "Guys, do you want to have a look at this?" And he just turned the camera around, and we all had a look, and it was the Twin Towers.
Yeah, he got the news report down his viewfinder
of his camera, and he turned around and showed us, and we just like...
It was the most surreal thing.
We went up to our room that we had there and watched the telly, and we didn't know what to say. Everyone was really quiet all day, and it was kind of... Yeah, it was obviously... It was a bit of a moment, you know. Mm. Pretty horrible moment, really.
Yeah.
Ever see a blind man cross the road, trying to make the other side? Ever see a young girl growing old, trying to make herself a bride?
BFBS.
Music.
Turin Breaks. In session.
Let's go to second album. Written here, recorded in LA, and you worked with Tony Hoffer, who was working with Depeche Mode. He's done massive things with The Thrills, Beck for Fratellis. Mm. Resulted in Painkiller. Gold album, Aether Song, 4 days after you released it, it went gold.
Mm.
So... can you go back to that particular time? So you did all your writing in Kent, was that right?
We thought we were making the record in Kent, in Chris Difford's old studio. And we kind of thought we were making the second album, but by the time we finished, we realised it wasn't quite up to mustard. And we decided, you know what, trying to do it the way we did the first one isn't really going to work. For some reasons, things have shifted and we need kind of reignited. And that's when the idea of working with Tony turned up. I can't remember whose idea it was with Tony, but he was just suggested, and we went and met him. That we really liked him because he pretty much said, you know, I like your first album, but
It was kind of
said it was boring.
It was boring, you know. And it weird, but I know it sounds ridiculous, but at the time that was exactly what we needed to hear, was someone not saying the Optimist LP is the perfect record, you'll never make a better one, because that's what people were saying and still do say. We needed to go with someone who was like, no, we got a new adventure, you know, for you guys. It was really lovely, like going to LA. It was we made it in this fantastic studio called the Sound Factory, and worked with a bunch of
Chinese kind of gang of musicians, like kind of Beck and Air kind of session guys, all really good at what they do, all really excited about everything all the time.
And it was a lovely taste, wasn't it, of a different world.
Do you feel like that was kind of like a shot in the arm?
It was exactly what we needed to do. I don't regret it for a second. I remember at the time we wouldn't have gone anywhere unless we did something like that. We had to do something totally different.
I think every record, every album needs a direction.
Yeah.
You have to have a vision for it and a direction. And we've learned that over the years, and we put that into practice, you know, now as well. If you haven't got that sort of feel or direction for it, or, you know, vision, you might as well not make it. Mm. And so that's what Tony did, because
what was cool about Ether Song was we did make a very different sounding record, completely different, really like proggy and a bit more experimental, but it worked.
It did.
It actually worked, and it was as commercially as successful, in fact more so internationally than The Optimist was. And that was quite like to have done that twice in a row. Now I look back and think, wow, lightning struck twice for us there. Mm. You know, it was a good achievement.
And it was nice to be in Los Angeles as well.
Oh man, it was so lovely.
Such a good place to go and do music.
If I can just touch on Painkiller for a minute, because you're going to do that for us in just a couple of seconds, which is going to be great. But it just sounds like you've recorded Sunshine. And I think a lot of people, that was, I can remember driving up and down the UK in, you know, this old banger, going off to festivals and stuff. And that was the soundtrack. You know, that was what, you know, you put on. It was like, oh yeah, someone's here. It's really cool. Yeah. How do you feel being over there? Do you think that was definitely the catalyst for that particular single?
Actually, there's a kind of, it's an interesting tale with Painkiller, because we took it over to the sessions with Tony, and it was kind of like part of the pack of interesting songs, but it wasn't like a really important one. We did attempt it with Tony in LA, and it was one of the stragglers. Like, it didn't quite work. It wasn't quite as good as the other tracks. There was something kind of missing about it. And then we got back to London to mix the record in a place called the Strong Rooms, and Tony kind of pulled it back out of the waste bin almost, you know, and said, you know, there's something about this song. Tony is brilliant. He's got such a good ear for like indie pop.
Yes.
You know, he really has. And he pulled that song back out of the bin, and we'd slightly given up on it until he kind of messed with it. And we changed a few things, re-recorded about two-thirds of it in the Strong Rooms, and it just sounded like a million bucks by the time we'd sort of finished tweaking it. And then the next thing, you know, we put that song out and it just did amazing. You know, it was top five, you know, just, it was like a taste of weird sort of mega pop for five minutes, you know, and still goes down very, very well, you know. So it's lovely.
If we go with Painkiller now from the second album, a bit of California Sunshine for us.
Painkiller was kind of the big pop number off Ether Song, but it was made in Los Angeles, and it was our first go at sort of being in on the west coast of America, which we'd always wanted to do, and then suddenly here we were actually doing it. And I like the idea that it really seems to somehow capture a bit of west coast sunshine somehow onto the tape. And it's still, I still sort of think about all that stuff whenever we play it. So here it is.
Batten up the hatches, here come the cold. I can feel it creeping, it's making me old. You give me so much love that it blows my brains out. You need something better than the beginning days. The creaking in the walls and the banging in the bed. You give me so much love that it blows my brains out. Summer rain dripping down your face again. Summer rain, praying someone feels the same. Take the pain, the killer, cycle on your bicycle. Leave all this misery behind.
become a cold. I can feel it creeping, it's making me old. You give me so much love that it blows my brains out. Summer rain, dripping down your face again. Summer rain, praying someone feels the same. Take the pain, killer, cycle on your bicycle. Leave all this misery
in breaks in session.
If we can stick with second album-ish kind of time, tensions were starting to rise with the record label. The expectations were quite huge for you guys. You are indie in every sense of the word. I mean, you DJ, you write for other people, not only yourselves. You've recorded some awesome covers. Actually, Breaking the Girl is one of my covers that I really like that you do.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
I actually quite like
well.
That better than the
we
original.
Did that in Los Angeles as well.
Did you?
Yeah, we did.
Yeah. I didn't know that. Yeah. I didn't,
know that. Max,
I didn't know that.
Fleetwood Mac studio.
Yeah, we did.
KCLW.
Do you feel that because you are so hands-on musically and also from a business point of view, do you think that increased the tensions with the record label?
You know, our sort of indie thing that we do these days has come... It was more sort of as a reaction to that time. It wasn't like we were sort of trying to be something we weren't at that moment. We were just kind of, as Gail said earlier, it was all new to us. So we were kind of learning on the fly. But it was bonkers. I mean, after Painkiller, and this will give you an idea of sort of what it was like, they wanted, obviously the label were like, right, give us another one of those, you know. And we were like, sure. Well, we haven't got another one of those. That is the only clear, you know, blatant pop song on the whole of this otherwise quite experimental record that we've made. What do you want us to do? And they said, right, you know, get together, write a song, we'll fly you to LA, go and make it with Tony. So we did that, and we made this song with Tony over a 24-hour period.
Yeah.
Gail was still putting down his guitar parts at 5 a.m. and at 7 a.m. we had to go and shoot the video for the song that we hadn't finished yet. So we did that, and we took in this DAT tape of an unfinished mix that we were working to, which was completely nuts. And the budget for this video was like more than a flat in Balham, you know. And then that night we had a sold out show at the Troubadour, so we had to go from making that video to this sold out show. And then we flew home. That was all across like 2 or 3 days, you know. And that's kind of the level that it got to. It was crazy. But, you know, we certainly had a good time. It wasn't like we were sitting there with our heads in our hands reeling. We were having a great time. It was just looking back, it makes you realise.
But that was pressure to repeat something.
Yeah.
And pressure to repeat doesn't work very well.
No, it just doesn't work. Things don't work like that. There's no formula.
No.
You know, you try and do it again, it just won't work.
Mm. If I can take you back to a gig that I was actually at in 2009, you guys played Canterbury. I was working at a radio station there at the time. It was Folk in the Barn. I don't know if you remember. That's right.
So the cathedral.
You debuted Paper Heart that night.
Yeah, yes.
Do you remember?
Paper Heart. Yeah, Paper Heart.
There was a review that was written, and I don't know if you've ever read it, and I'll have to find it and print it out for you. Apparently someone was in the audience that were actually reduced to tears. Do you know this?
No, don't, but no, I didn't know.
That happens every time we speak.
Every time we speak.
This is for all the right reasons, though. It was a very good performance, I can assure you. Do you have any sort of gigs that you've done that stick into your mind? Like when you hear stuff like that and those sort of memories, is there any particular show or maybe tour support or anything like that that kind of really sticks in your mind?
I definitely remember V2003 because I think we played to about 30 plus thousand people. We were second headline on the kind of like the second stage. I think it was the enemy stage or something. And I think Coldplay were playing on the main stage, and we'd managed to retain this colossal crowd, which it was the first time we'd ever really had that moment where we felt like they'd come to see us.
Yes.
The promoters were shocked. Was that the one?
Promoters were very shocked. Yeah,
there was something like 28,000 people there.
And we really did have a vibe with the crowd. Like it was amazing, you know. Oh, it was just lovely. That was quite a special moment, you know, for me.
Yeah, I remember that. Clearly, it's a good one. There were some girls making some very lewd hand signals.
Oh, there were, weren't there? In fact, they were so lewd. They were so lewd that I think Gail had to stop playing.
Gail stopped playing his guitar.
Couldn't play.
I looked up to wonder what had happened, and I saw this girl doing these kind of... I won't do it because I've got a camera there, but... these kind of strange gestures that I realised what she was saying, and Gail obviously just, what? And then
he'd stopped playing.
Yeah, he'd stopped playing.
The whole band just ground to a halt.
They'd all taken their tops off, hadn't they? I think it was maybe that as much as the gestures.
And then our eyes kind of all went left to where all the girlfriends and wives were standing and were looking at us with their sort of going, no.
Doing the throat cut sign.
And we were going, it's not us.
We're not doing it.
We can't control the crowd. So you can imagine there was like a lot of weird tensions. You know, we're looking at them off stage and looking at them not in the crowd. It's like, whoa. Where do I look? What am I doing?
That would have been interesting after show party.
Yeah. We got away with it just.
All right, let's go.
Turin Breaks in Session.
BFBS.
All right, let's talk about the seventh studio album. It's out now. It's been very well received. Welcome back. 15 long years. Mm. How do you feel about this new body of work? I mean, you must be thrilled.
You know, we're still in the middle of it, so it's hard to say it, but it has been such a good year for us, you know, especially having been through everything we've been through, doing it for, I think, 17 years or something ridiculous. I think everyone in the band just truly appreciates where we're at currently, which is a very nice place to be, which is the album's been received brilliantly. Lots of people went out and bought it, and the Turin Breaks fans are sort of like reinvigorated again. But also things like our the first single got really blasted on the radio, which was thrilling, you know, just to suddenly find yourselves back on the radar a bit. And we really feel it, because at the end of the day, we're just four guys driving ourselves up and down around Europe playing gigs, you know, we're just musicians. So you really feel it, you know, at this level. And it's been a great year.
I think there's a real feeling of comfort. Like it's like this quietly confident, just really touching sound that you have created, I think, for this album. It's a welcome back of your sound, but it's also kind of like a real confident sort of, this is what we are. Yeah. This is what we are about.
I suppose that's what time will do to you. You know, because we've been doing it long enough.
Well, time will heal you.
Time will save you.
Time will save you.
Like that.
One of those.
Time gives you that confidence.
Keep Me Around. Tell me a little bit about this.
Keep Me Around. Bit of a twisted love song, I guess. And it's the first song off the new album, Lost Property. And so we're just very proud of being able to put it out, and the fact that people seem to have liked it. So everyone likes it.
You kill the crowd in my head with the naysayers dead. I guess I can finally let go of all my uncertainty, all great divides and meet their demise. Meet me in the honey of ourselves. We're one in a billion bullets of love.
happy if heaven's the edge? What lies above if I am? Oh, this world, so inexplicable, parallel universe ticks out of time. Yes, if the gods have gone crazy, then we've found a place for us to dive in.
BFBS.
Music.
Turin Breaks. In session.
You've obviously served your time playing every, you know, hole up and down the country. How do you guys feel about these sort of overnight discovery bands that pop up on Britain's Got Talent and X Factor and all these sorts of shows? What do you think of that?
I don't wish them any harm at all, personally. We kind of had our time. It feels like there was the windows open for us and we did our best to jump through it, and it was kind of simpler before.
Yes.
So I don't have... Those guys, good luck to them, you know, as long as they understand it might not last here today, gone tomorrow.
Well,
you know,
you've got to have a lot
of
time as well, because when you're beginning and you don't have a team around you, you've got to do every layer of social media would take your entire day, let alone writing good songs and doing a gig. I mean, you've got to, if you were starting now, it would be quite a daunting prospect.
We wouldn't bother.
You probably wouldn't. It'd be easier to sort of find some kind of job and just being in a pub band, you know.
I think we'd do music for ourselves. Yeah, just say, exactly, forget it. Yeah. Look at that mountain you've got to climb just to get someone to listen to the actual song. Forget it, man.
That's true.
What is it like for you guys when you are playing to huge big crowds and you've got people in the audience like singing your lyrics back at you?
Still pretty magical. I mean, boy, it must be, because we play so many shows. If it was anything but sort of an energy-giving experience, we just would not be able to do it, because it's just bloody exhausting, quite frankly, driving around all day long and playing gigs when you really just want to go to bed at that point, especially if you've got kids, you know. It's amazing. You know, and Turin Breaks fans, they're just getting more and more passionate. You know, that I don't like using that word, but it's true. I read somewhere actually on Twitter the other day, someone said, I love the way you guys have kind of survived by treating your fans right and just putting out really good music and playing gigs and just doing it the right way. And it was really nice to read, because I was like, yeah, I guess that's what's happened. You know, we've just done it. Hopefully, for the right reasons.
But say, if every gig we do, we totally do the best we can. Mm. If every record we make, you know, it's always about
just
not
always
being
do
lazy,
it
just do
good.
It properly, yeah. And exactly respect the people who are into it. You know, and it's great when someone says that, because that's exactly what we tried to do. Especially as we focus more again in the recent period, it's like they're all coming up with it again. It's like a mass, I don't know, there's a kind of mass positivity somewhere. I'm sounding like a hippie now. I was just shooting. But you know what I mean? There is some weird thing going on.
They will shoot you on this station.
Actually,
you do know that.
Sorry, I didn't say that.
Yes, you are behind the wire, boys. Oh. Need I remind you? Right, okay, so let's go for highlights over the last 20 years.
Oh my goodness me, highlights. You know what, this
interview.
This interview is the highlight of my entire career. Apart from that, when we had the single from this album, Keep Me Around, when it got A-listed on Radio 2 and then went out on all the, you know, across the UK playlists on all the different stations and everything, that was a really big and positive moment for me. And that was a massive highlight personally as well as for the band, because I do all the background work and stuff like that.
And for you, Ollie?
I think this year related, really. I think it was probably just the last swathe of touring, and basically, you know, we're well-trained pessimists in this band. We always keep the expectations very low, and we went all the way around the UK. We did far too many shows, if you ask me, like ridiculous amount of shows, and I was like, oh my god, these are going to be half empty, this is just ridiculous, and they were absolutely packed. Then we went around Europe and I thought the same thing. I thought, oh, no one's going to turn up to this. We'd be lucky if we fill half these rooms up, and they were packed. And then we went around Germany and they were packed, and it was just like, wow, I truly didn't think that could happen at this point. And that was just thrilling. It makes the whole thing, it makes everything better. It makes when you're talking to your mother-in-law, it makes that much better. It makes talking to anyone else, it just makes everything better. It's kind of confirming that your crazy dreams weren't that crazy after all.
We recently did a gig somewhere in Lyme. It was a Lyme Folk Festival, and there was someone in the audience who said to one of the guys who's organising it, he said, their old guitarist was pretty good, but this new young guy they got is absolutely incredible.
That was
kind of made up.
They said, this young kid.
Yeah,
that's me.
That was
brilliant.
Yeah. So that was quite a highlight.
You're like the Peter Pan of touring breaks.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
Younger and younger and better and better.
It's true.
And for you, Eddie?
Just being able to build my life around music and play music every day as part of what I do for my living is just something I dreamed about, but I never really thought it would happen. And so every day that it's, I check every morning, it's like, wake up, it's still happening. You know, it's unbelievable, really. And compared to that, anything that may go wrong along the way is insignificant, really.
What about when we got on Top of the Pops? That was probably quite a highlight.
That's one of many. You know, I could say
we were on that show all the time.
We were on Top of the Pops all the time.
You know, I could talk about playing Glastonbury 2003 and just a whole bunch. You know, but that's all. You know, it's all in the past. What I'm doing even right now is fantastic. You know, and knowing that there's more to come.
Have you got a message for any of our serving personnel, guys and girls, especially out on ops?
I'm slightly unqualified, I feel, for this, but I would just say, you know, keep your hope up, keep your courage up, kind of remember your personal reasons for doing what you're doing in your life. Just try and, you know, remember your long-term plan and enjoy the short-term feelings.
The upcoming third single from the new album?
Yeah, this one, it's a live favourite. We started playing it live before we'd, you know, demoed it, I think, or pretty much. And the audience really responded quite well. So we thought, OK, we might be onto a winner here. So, and we liked playing it anyway, because it makes us feel kind of, I don't know, like sort of slightly like sort of pop rock gods or something, you know. At the time, it just feels really great fun, and we always got a smile on our face. And but you know, we're not mocking it. You know, we love that kind of thing as well. And then one time, we finished the song, and Ollie turned around and said, "That should be the theme tune from Top Gun 3." And after that, I've never been able to get that out of my mind. I think that's fantastic. But don't worry about it. Just enjoy. Yeah, you know,
have you done the music video for this yet?
We haven't done it yet.
Okay. There you go. I've got a few friends.
We're open to offers.
Jets around the back.
Available.
Might be able to help you out there. Excellent. We can get the RAF involved.
Okay, perhaps. Well, might have to pull pull that one in.
All right, so let's have a listen then. Jumpstart, this is great.
In the morning I'll be alone. It doesn't matter where I go. In the back of the bus, in the middle of a life, waiting for the next show. I'm just a lost cardboard kid, stuck in the background. From the bugs in the ground to the stars in the sky, I need the sound of an old friend. Why don't you sing to me? I'm like a burned out car. Whoa, under the throat.
jump start. A jump start. In a world on repeat, everyone asleep at the wheel. I'm the boy in the bubble looking for trouble who forgot to feel. And there's a spark between the day and the night. I'm the kid in the playground that's been let down. I need the sound of an old friend. Why don't you sing to me? A jump start. In the morning I'll be alone. It doesn't matter where I go.